Well, thank you, Mr. Radabaugh. I'm always willing to acquiesce, so if we need to, here we go. Well, if there's one thing that we as humans tend to be very good at, it's telling other people what we want them to do. And if there's something that we have a difficult time with, I might propose that it is us sitting on the receiving end of that. Because oftentimes when we're told something to do, we can be left with the question of why. What is the rationale behind it? We would like to know more of that basis. And it starts young. The why question, oftentimes people will say, the moment kids start talking, you get into that toddler age frame, the 4 to 5, it just really maximizes. And why? Why would go and clean your room? Why? And one of the difficulties that we face as parents, and I would say actually also as Christians, it can be so easy for us to fall into the trap of just wanting to give an answer of because I said so. Or maybe you say, well, it's really good for you to clean your room because then you're going to produce this other character and you're going to become a more responsible person. And we'll go into this other rationale and we'll explain all of those things. The difficulty is that when we give an answer to why, we can sometimes miss the opportunity to hit the underlying principle of bringing them along to see why we came up with. And so I'm actually wanting to, as I've been thinking about this a bit more, I'm looking at my kids as they're getting older, and I'm thinking, I'm a third generation in walking this way. And I had to come to the conclusion as to why it is that I said yes to God, why it is that I am where I am right now, and ask myself whether or not I have instilled that appropriately so for my kids. And so I'm endeavoring to go out on this new journey here, in discussion, in these messages, to kind of try to address the base questions of our Christianity. So that we can arrive at, or I shouldn't even say should we can watch, so that we can arrive at, so that we can equip one another to have the conversations, to not just give an answer. This is what I want you to do because I said so. This is what we do because we're Christian. But instead to actually get at the underlying development of our own individual relationship with God. And I will say that this is not something that I had a pastor walk me through, not even during my baptism counseling. It's not something that I had my parents walk me through. And sometimes when we don't have that journey or we don't take the time to go through the intellectual exercise, you can have a crisis of faith. Why is it that I'm doing this? Why, out of all the things, is this the path that I am on? And sometimes we can feel lost if we don't have that. So I'm hoping to be able to equip not only my kids, but each of us in our mindset and our thought process for engaging with other people. Perhaps don't just give an answer, but walk alongside someone and help them to develop the answer themselves. Why is it that you would want to clean your room? Why is it that you would want to do these things? So, I'd like to lay out a couple ground rules when we're talking about this, and it might seem odd to do this in the midst of a service that we're having God present here, but we are not going to assume right off the bat that the Bible is His inspired word. We are not going to assume that the Bible is His inspired word. We're not actually going to even assume that God exists. We want to start at the very beginning. So we're not going to assume that the Bible is inspired. We're not going to assume that God exists. And we are going to treat counterpoints, whether they're atheism or any other thought process, Gnosticism, we're going to treat them as something to be considered. Now, I'm not saying something to accept, but something to consider. Because this is what rational thought dictates. And oftentimes, I can think of a scripture that says, come, let us reason together. Let's look at what is here. If it can't stand on its own, why are we doing it? I've often said, if you don't believe fully in what we're doing, why are you even here? Because this is crazy if you don't believe it passionately so. I mean, we are zealots. You might not think of yourself as a zealot, but if you're here on a Sabbath and you follow the food laws and you observe the holy days that God has outlined, even amongst the Christian component of this country, we're zealots. So, we're not assuming that the Bible is inspired. We're not assuming that God exists. We're not going to assume, or we're not going to, we're going to take arguments from and counterpoints as they are, and we want to follow where the evidence leads. Sometimes, even as Christians, that can be uncomfortable because it means that we have to let go of thoughts that we had that are based on tradition and other things. So, as we're endeavoring to start at the beginning here, the very basis, I will also say, I am continuing the study in this. If you're like, hey, what about this counterpoint, Nathan? Please, let me know. I'll try to integrate it in. If I miss something, we'll come back. Because this is, as much as it's not a full interactive service, this is our walk with God. And this is our relationship with Him. I think it's important for us to consider. So the first question, the first why, and that is the title of today's message is why. It's very descriptive, but I think it encapsulates everything. When we're looking at what is around us, why is there something and not nothing? Why is there something and not nothing? And you can take this to the utmost extreme if you would like. You're looking up into the sky. Why is a chair here? Why am I here? Why are there things around us as opposed to nothing? Because in the scheme of everything, there's actually a lot of what seems like dead space. You look up and you see stars, but there's a lot of space between them. There's space between us here in this room. But why is there something instead of nothing? Now, one position to take on this is that it just is. Clearly it is, because look, it's here right in front of you. You can observe it. There are the natural laws, and you can look around and you say, I can observe this. I can see it. It's here because it is. Kind of like it's self-existent. Maybe it always has been. And it's just always been around. You can go into other, generally the more tribal perspectives. But everything just keeps going back. There was a movie, an animated movie not too long ago, that talked about the creation of the world, and everything was just elephants all the way down. There are other theories that they're actually turtles, and the world is sitting on top of a large catfish or a large turtle. There are all sorts of different ideas, but it just always has been. It is there. It's like that. It has been in memoriam. There are other ideas that maybe it popped out of nothing. Perhaps some of these you might have learned or heard. You know, it came from nothing. Well, there was nothing, and now there is something, and now it is, and we know that it is because we're here. But it's a difficult thing because all we have to base things off of is what we can see, what we can hear, what we can taste, smell, touch, and those various things. But as we continue to ask the question of why there is something instead of nothing, perhaps our mind moves then to another question. If there is something now, either it's always been around or it came from nothing. If it came from nothing, does nothing produce something? And these are things that I would encourage all of us. Sometimes you're like, well, obviously, nothing can't produce something. Or, well, clearly, you can have nothing and then you can have something. Look, I left the house and I came back and dinner is on the table, right? It depends on how you're observing things. It depends on your point of reference. But we have to be honest with ourselves as we think about this, because the only points of reference that we have are what we have seen. Any other point of reference that we accept is coming from someone that has given it to us, and we're either going to accept it or we're going to discredit it. Oftentimes, depending on the depth of the relationship, the type of relationship we have with the person. Right? So, am I going to accept someone else's perception? Do I think that that's the case? So, we ask the question then, can nothing produce something? In my experience, I haven't seen nothing produce something. Ever. And this leads to what a lot of philosophers will call the cosmological dilemma. Because if everything begins to exist, everything that has come into existence has only come into existence because something else caused it to come into existence. Dinner didn't just show up on the table. My wife and my kids put in the effort and the time to do that. And so while I was gone, not to come into existence. This is where you get the chicken and the egg dilemma, right? Well, which came first? Well, could the chicken will itself out of the egg if it started with the egg? How did you get the chicken if you didn't have the egg? And you get this dilemma that goes on. And it ends up being, you can only in this thought process before you come to the realization that there seems to be something that caused what we see, what has become what we see. Something caused that. Again, we're not saying what it was, but something, whether it's, you know, you have that cause and effect chain. If you've ever seen anything from like the early 90s or late 80s, on the top of every desk of every executive, they have those five steel balls on the strings. You pull one out, tap, 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 tap. They're going back and forth. You have this equal and opposite reaction, but you have something causing something else. It's on their own, and we see that. We look around, and we, through our observation, come to the conclusion that you don't get something from nothing. But then if you have something, how did you get something if there was nothing? How far back does that go? And your brain can start to feel like it's in a bit of a riddle. How do you get here? Patients within ourselves or amongst ourselves, because at times you can just take for granted all the perceptions that have been handed down to you. And I will tell you, in Christianity, there are a lot of those perceptions that get handed down. And if we don't take the time to step back and be like, okay, what is to this? Is there anything to this? Then we can be caught up pretty quickly. So let's dive into a couple other philosophical or scientific considerations when it comes to this idea of why there is something instead of nothing. I think we've probably all heard of Aristotle. If you haven't heard of Aristotle yet, he's an ancient Greek philosopher. He was in and around the 300s BC. He was a student of Plato. Plato's very well known within the social sciences, but Aristotle took what Plato taught when you're talking about science and logic. But he took that to another level, actually. And so he is kind of considered the pioneer, the first true scientist. And he just went from theoretical and philosophical thoughts to then trying to come up with the concepts of theorems and proofs and how you would get to an end result. He was actually a teacher of Alexander the Great. And he had a reason. He said that there are causal chains. When it comes to causal chains, and causal chains is kind of like you pull back the little metal ball and it hits the other one and you get this movement. An action causes another action. But he said causal chains cannot regress infinitely. Meaning, I mentioned that the animated movie, that it's just elephants all the way down. You get to a point, you can't just keep saying that it's elephants. You can't just keep saying that this caused this, but was caused by this. The causal link can't keep regressing and going back infinitely. In his writings on metaphysics, he says there must be something that causes motion without itself being moved. And this is what we call God. That's what Aristotle wrote in Metaphysics. There must be something that causes motion without itself being moved, and this is what we call God. And it's an interesting thought, because here's the individual who's purported as having established science, the rigorous scientific method, being the first one to start trying to prove things. But he looks and says, you know, there's something that has to start it. And in many societies, this is where they go back to and say, well, that's the creator. That is, you know, Remus and Romulus fighting. That's God, whatever form someone believes God to be. Later on in the 1200s, an Italian friar, a Dominican friar by the name of Thomas Aquinas, you may have heard the name. He's actually very popular for writing out he did a work called The Five Ways. And he's trying to prove the existence of God from kind of like a theorem's component, a theorem's perspective. He's saying, okay, we know that God exists because of X. And he went through five different theses for that. He was a philosopher, a theologian. He was trained in Aristotle's ways of philosophy. But he is quoted as saying this in his work, the Summa Theologica. He says, if in efficient causes, it is possible to go on to infinity, there will be no first efficient cause, nor will there be an ultimate effect. If you can keep going back We're trying to talk about efficiency and movement, and we understand if you push on something on this earth, does it continue to go forever? No. Friction, wind resistance, gravity, all these things that pull on it to stop it. It doesn't just go on forever. We can look at that on this orb where we live, and we can intellectually come to that conclusion. And he's saying, you know, even if we just talk about it, in pure efficiency, you can't keep going back. He came to the same conclusion as Aristotle, that you're not going to be able to keep going back. There has to be a beginning, because otherwise there's no ultimate effect, because you get into this loop of the snake eating its tail. It just keeps going. And so you get what is called circular reasoning, tautological reasoning. And so that's what Thomas Aquinas came to. Interestingly enough, modern cosmology and looking out into the stars has come to the same conclusion, that there is a beginning. There wasn't just an always has been. They're looking at the expansion of the universe, the speed with which it's expanding. There are arguments over whether it's speeding up or slowing down. Has it always been at this pace? But there is one core similarity across all of cosmology, and that is it did have a beginning. And so you don't have something, according to all the minds today, and the philosophers from the past, there had to be a beginning. And again, in the words of Aristotle, this is what we call God that started all of that. Stephen Hawking, a well-known British theoretical physicist, he wrote this. He says, "Almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang." And so when we're talking about where you come from, why is there something and not nothing? We understand that there is something. We can see it. We sit in it in a chair. We drove it to get here. There is something that is here. We look into the sky and we see it. There is something. And what all of the minds across time have come to the conclusion of is that that something didn't come from nothing. And if it didn't come from nothing, what is its basis? Let's look at two. We are actually going to open the Bible. Let's go there to Genesis chapter 1. Because we see this, and this is one of the things that I find to be so intriguing. I can quote Aristotle, I can quote Thomas Aquinas, I can quote Stephen Hawking. Now let's quote another reference material here in Genesis chapter 1. Verse 1 says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." We've read that likely dozens, if not hundreds of times. If you've ever started to read the Bible in a year, you've done it. You might not get much farther than this. You're like, oh, time goes on. But we read this one, and in the beginning. But there's a lot that is here, because it's not just the beginning of the Bible. What Moses is recording here in the first book of the Pentateuch is he's recording that from the Hebrew recorded verses, what we have here on our laps or on our phones, when we look in Scripture, it also references a beginning, not something that just always has been. There is a beginning. And so what we believe and understand as we look at Scripture and what the Scriptures point to is the same thing that we see outlined by ancient theologians, philosophers, cosmologists, current ones as well. Let's jump down to verse 14 here. It says, "Then God says, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth, and it was so." Speaking about the separation there, you're having the stars in the sky, the sun and the moon, these things are put into place for time, for the keeping of times and seasons. So we know that there is a beginning, and we know that those things are set into motion based on what it says here in Scripture to keep time. And this is exactly corroborated with what we see going on in science and cosmology and philosophy and and astronomy and across time, what we see in Scripture. Well, at the same time, you have people who are believing that the whole reason that the sun comes up is because, you know, it's an orb that is running away from someone else, or somebody in a chariot, or the reason that it disappears is because a serpent eats it at night. It's not because it's there for times and seasons, and yet what we see that has been brought out across time, consider this, not Christian people, it corroborates with what we see in Scripture. Let's jump over to Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4. Hebrews chapter 3, verse 4. Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4 says, "For every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God." Remember we talked about the action? How far back can the cause go? You can't just keep saying, there was a cause, there was a cause, there was a cause, there was a cause, there was a cause. And there's always been something to cause this reaction to occur. Aristotle said, there must be something that causes motion without itself being moved. And this is what we call God. Recorded here in Hebrews, every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. This is the same concept. It didn't just appear, it didn't just happen. Why is there something? Because it was made to be so. Something caused it to happen. Let's move to a second why. As we look at things that are around us, and we can observe them, I had already alluded to this, but we can see that there is order of some sort to it. There are things that seem to be true, no matter what. When you put butter and jelly on that toast, and it falls, there is a law that says it will land jelly side down. And you can go into the physics, well, the weight and the flip and everything. But there are these laws that we see. Why is it that the laws of nature are so precisely tuned? The fact that we could walk here and not float away. The fact that there was enough friction on the brake pads of my car to stop and it didn't just keep going. The fact that all of the things around us abide by what seem to be so precisely tuned laws. How is that so? If we're taking the time to look at everything around and say, okay, why is it here? Why is there something and not nothing? We should naturally then flow into, okay, so it's here, it's not nothing. Why is it organized the way that it is? Why does it function the way that it does? Why do you have a guy who has an apple fall onto his head and goes, aha, I have a realization. Now you could take the position, we're just lucky. Now if things were different, we wouldn't be here. No one would be here. You wouldn't notice it. This is just, I mean, what a fantastic happenstance that it is the way that it is. This is one of those where you start getting into the laws of probability. It's like, this is where math is fun, because it just gets huge and astronomical. We'll actually reference this in a little bit. But if you're going to take the position like, wow, that just happened. And some people take that position. They like to go for kind of like that chaos theory. Well, it just happened to be that this is how it occurred. So here's where I live. This is what it is. I can see it. It's around me. I accept that it's here. But if we're going to go the route of a thinking person and ask ourselves, why is it here? Why is it so precisely tuned? Why is it that one change? And you can probably look at this. If there were different atomic weights, then all matter would behave differently. You know, they have to have those weights so that they can marry up. It's good that our water is not pure, because if it were pure, it is called the universal solvent for a reason, because it pulls from everything else. This is why when you just drink pure water, it will actually leach minerals from your body. If we had pure water running through, it would take from everything else and it would bond with it. So the fact that we have it the way that it's set up in just such a fashion, water is one of those weird things. When it goes into its solid form, it becomes less dense. Tell me something else that does that we know. Any of the elements, do you know that when they become solid forms, they become less dense? No, but water does. And which one do we need to survive? Well, we need water. Like, these are all so precisely, finely tuned to work with each other that it becomes difficult to take that skeptical position of, well, it just happened. Sir Roger Penrose, he was an English mathematician. He was a philosopher. He was a Nobel laureate in literature. And he calculated that the extraordinary, I'm reading a quote here, the extraordinarily special nature of the initial conditions, what it takes, that initial condition, seems to demand some deeper explanation. Because how do you get to arrive at where we are now? Because remember we talked about all those causal links going back and all the chain reaction it would have to get if to start at the very beginning. And he's saying that the extraordinarily special nature of the initial conditions seemed to demand some deeper explanation. He quantified the odds of having those special conditions at the beginning as being 1 in 10 to the 10,123rd. That's a lot of zeros, just in case, if you understand exponents. 10 to the 10,123rd. That is astronomically high. Nigh on impossible, if you will. You could win the lottery multiple times over. And you wouldn't even touch that. Paul Davies, he's a quantum physicist. He's a writer and professor. He admitted, he says, the impression of design is overwhelming just because of what it takes to have those initial conditions present for everything to function. If you have one part of the protein chain off, life does not occur. If you have other things that are going on that are out of whack, when you look at the relationships between plants and animals, when you're looking at even the order of how creation has to go, you realize that it takes a very special set of circumstances in order to be able to be where we are, to see what we see. Did I make it worse? So, we have these thinkers that are coming to the same conclusion. Now, thankfully, we live in the time of Marvel Comics, right? And there's the option of a multiverse. So we have all these other things that could theoretically have happened. And we just happen to be in the right spot at the right time. In fact, they're finding more and more universes that are out there as we're beyond the Hubble telescope now. And we're at, I'm trying to remember, I didn't write down the name of it. What's the new one that we have out there? Anybody remember? But it's bigger. It's like four times bigger. The Webb, there you go, the Webb telescope. And it's out there, and they're able to see far deeper into space. And they realize that there are what you thought were stars, there are other galaxies, right? It just keeps getting bigger, and we see more. So, now if we have an infinite possibility then of universes, do we not then also have an infinite possibility of life and things just occurring? But you know what happens when you go that route? Then you also have, if you have this multiverse concept, you have an infinite number of other universes that need to also have the same very specific laws in place to create life. Because you can't just talk about the odds here in this one spot and say, like, well, all of these, and we're the one that just happens to work. Because then to say that there's life somewhere else, you have to multiply those odds by themselves to have a second possibility of that happening. Does that make sense? So then you'd be like 1 times 10 to the... I don't know what 10,123 is, times 10,123, but that's what it would be for the odds of there being a second universe with life on it. Right? And so when you logically deduce, and we're going through and walking through why it is that the laws are so precisely tuned, and they just happen to be here, as Sir Roger Penrose and as Paul Davies came to that conclusion, they said the impression of design is overwhelming. There needs to be deeper explanation at that initial condition. Stephen, for decades, and what they've actually found, one of them left the what they call the pull of the sun and the effects of the sun on our solar system, and is now outside of the influence of our sun. And it went out in one portion of it. And our sun is a star that is hurtling through space. And so one of them left on one version. She left the pole of the solar system at a different spot. And what they find is actually that you have a variation in the effects of the sun and the planets on the radio frequencies that are getting to these satellites that are out there in space. So it's thicker in some areas, thinner in others. But you see a variation in the pole and the moon that's out there. And so the information that they're sending back is, we see variation. We see that the laws that we thought would be in place aren't over there, but they're still abiding by the same core laws that have governed so much else. I mean, They did outside of our solar system. The satellites didn't. They're still functioning. They're still able to receive signals from them. But again, as Stephen Hawking said, the laws themselves may have originally been created, because you don't get to this level of complexity and the very refinement that it takes for them all to work together by happens. 1 times 10 to the 10,123rd. Let's look at Psalm 19. Psalm 19. Why are the laws of nature so precisely tuned? So much of what we experience and what has come to be found is that if they weren't so precisely tuned, we would not so precisely exist. So it's kind of nice to have them just as they are. Psalm 19, verse 1 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork." When we look at what is there, and it's not just, it can be easier for us to look up into the night sky and to be in awe. We know that King David did this. But you look up, he says, "Oh, what is man that you're so mindful of him?" God has made all of that, but He has also made everything that we see and the laws that govern our day to day, that keep us able to breathe. We oftentimes talk about breathing oxygen, but the vast majority of our atmosphere is nitrogen and all these other gases, and the perfect combination to be able to have us have life. And as it says here, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork." We'll look at a New Testament extension of this in Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. Romans chapter 1, verse 20. It says, "For since the creation of the world," again alluding to that beginning, "since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes," the laws that govern things, what God has set in motion, "are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." We see them. We discover them. These laws that seem to govern what is going on around us, these theorems, these things that are in place that we can figure out. The fact that you can say, "Well, how much exact thrust does it take to force this amount of weight up and out of the atmosphere?" That you can measure the density of the atmosphere at different heights. And yet it needs to be so for us to be able to develop the bone density that we need, for us to be able to have the oxygen that we breathe, for us to be able to have air currents, tides, all the things that we have that are so finely tuned for us to be here. If it wasn't so, we would not exist. And as Scripture shows us, again, it's a creation of God, and it is clearly seen. People understand this. This is why we have laws of physics, laws of thermodynamics. Things change. They modify, but within the boundaries of what is clearly known. Because of that, you can have rocket thrust. Because of that, you can have maglev trains. Because of that, we can have cell phones that are beaming signals back and forth. These are all things that are based off of the consistent specificity of the laws that have been discovered by man to be present. Without these laws being so precisely tuned, we would not exist. I think we'll take a pause there. We'll pick up, I've got three more points, 3, 4, and 5. We'll do that in the second half of the message, but we'll have a break here.
Thank you, Mr. Ekema. I'm reminded of a theory that a good friend had growing up, that since toast with jelly always lands face down,